Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a growing push in Michigan to start exporting more food, soybeans, cherries, apples, blueberries, and do it internationally. On today's show, we look at the consequences for farmers, consumers, and the state's economy if more Michigan-grown food leaves the state. And then former Michigan Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land has tossed her hat into the 2014 Senate race, a seat that's open, of course, because of Carl Levin's retirement. We'll talk to Land about why she wants to be the Republican nominee, and that'll be later in the show. But first, it seems there's at least one thing that we can all agree on in this state: the need to fix our roads, potholes, crumbling bridges, decades-old infrastructure. What we can't seem to agree on, though, is how to pay for those fixes. As we've talked about before on Stateside, Governor Snyder wants more than $1 billion, and he wanted it just this year alone to fix the state's roads and bridges. The governor floated the idea of boosting the gas tax and drivers paying more vehicle registration fees. Neither of those proposals gained much traction in Lansing. And now the state budget is close to being completed with only about $350 million in road funding. So all of this leads to the question, why is it so hard to find a way to fix our roads? Craig Thiel is a senior consultant at Anderson Economic Group here in Michigan. He recently wrote a piece in Bridge Magazine titled, "Will There Ever Be a Good Time to Fund Road Repairs?" Such a question. Craig, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Why is it so hard, Craig, when basically everyone agrees the roads are in awful shape after years of disinvestment?
Well, part of the reason, I think, is people don't like taxes. We understand that. And this tends to be a tax that we see every day as we're traveling to work, school, or to recreate. And when we go by the gas station and have to fill up, we see that price of gasoline climbing, and baked in there is the gas tax that we pay to fund our roads.
And it's interesting. I think for most drivers, they don't notice the bad conditions of the road as much as they notice how doggone annoying it is when the roads are being fixed. So even as what is good for us is being done, we don't like it.
Yeah, that's right. It's an inconvenience. Obviously, living in a northern climate, road construction has a limited season. And it seems when we're trying to get places in a hurry in the summer and springtime, we're confronted with orange barrels and the like.
Do you think, Craig, this is this a failure of ideas and of big thinking about ways to pay for our roads in 2013? I mean, these proposals Governor Snyder announced, the increase in the gas tax and the increase in the vehicle registration fees, we've all heard these before. They've been talked about, and they haven't gone anywhere.
You know, we fund our roads primarily using user fees, so gas tax and registration taxes, and those tend to be the preferred methods across most states to take care of infrastructure. The thinking there is that people who pay or who use the infrastructure should pay for it, and it makes a lot of sense. As far as innovative approaches, there's a few out there, and the governor certainly offered up one, which would be a wholesale tax on gasoline. The advantages there, unlike the current 19 cent per gallon excise taxes, it would be tied to the price of fuel, which we know over time has been rising, and so it has a built-in inflator. So we don't right out of the gate all of a sudden see a erosion of the tax revenues that are generated for roads. So that is an innovative approach to this. The vehicle registration tax is a pretty straightforward. It's based on the value of vehicles. And again, that tends to have a built-in inflation adjustment too. As the costs of vehicles rise, the amount that you pay as a user also increases.
And yet no one's getting behind those.
No, I don't think so. And again, this is a proverbial kicking the can down the road scenario. I guess the caveat would be this is a much more bumpy road now.
Yes.
As the can gets bumped down the road. You know, the last time we raised the gas tax was in 1997, and almost within the first few years, the increase in that 4 cent gas tax was eroded by inflation. And so they've been dealing with both a fixed rate and the base. The amount of fuel that's being consumed is decreasing. So it's kind of a double whammy when it comes to fuel taxes in the state of Michigan.
I just have to say, as we speak today, I don't think anyone listening to us is saying, yeah, sign me up for higher gas prices.
No, I think you're right. People see that tax baked into the price of a gallon of gas every day as they're traveling down the roads. And, you know, there's some hesitancy to do that. One proposal that had been floated would peel away the sales tax that's currently collected on fuel and then replace that with an increase in a fuel tax or registration tax. By doing that, the belief is that the price at the pump won't go up. And you can do the math to make that happen. The problem is the sales tax right now doesn't go to roads or bridges. It primarily goes to schools, and so it solves a problem on the road infrastructure side of state priorities, but it creates a problem on the school funding side.
And we already know that's a big hot potato. I'm speaking with Craig Thiel, who's with Anderson Economic Group here in Michigan. His recent piece in Bridge Magazine really sums it up perfectly. Will there ever be a good time to fund road repairs? I'm wondering, Craig, for your thoughts, how long can lawmakers keep getting away with these short-term solutions? Like what we're seeing in this upcoming budget, truly that $350 million is a sneeze compared to what everybody agrees, independent sources as well, that more than $1 billion that's needed.
Yes, it is a fraction of the over $1 billion that's needed. And that's been documented by, you know, multiple unbiased, bipartisan work groups going back a number of years. One of the problems that is faced is that number doesn't get smaller. The more that investment falls behind, the larger that future increase is going to be.
I'm not hearing any solutions.
There's solutions out there. The political will seems to be a little wanting on this one. Clearly, when the state found some additional revenues that were going to be available,
yes.
This was an identified hole, those revenues were going to fund transportation. I don't think that the fiduciaries of the state should be banking on found money each year to invest in our primary infrastructure in the state. To commit each year to funding is the right way to go, I think.
So I think I'm hearing that lawmakers aren't stepping up to the challenge. As you say, the political will not being there to embrace what could be fixes.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. You know, Michigan had some tough economic times, and by all accounts, raising taxes was not going to help businesses and individuals. But Michigan's rebounding, and we're doing better than the nation as a whole. And it wasn't a good time to raise taxes in a lot of people's minds because of the souring economy. And now that the economy is improving, it also seems like people don't want to raise taxes. The constant during the last 10 years has been that we've been underinvesting in road and bridge infrastructure in the state, and that's not likely going to change.
Now, I have to just ask something that occurs to me every time my family and I are on road trips, and we go through Ohio into Pennsylvania, or we go on the Skyway to Chicago, and we stop at the toll road on the turnpike and drop money in the box. Has that ever been considered as an option in Michigan to convert roads to turnpikes and make the users pay to use them?
You know, I think there's some discussion. It would have to be done in those areas of the state where you're really the highways are serving as main thoroughfares from one destination to the other, as opposed to just getting across town.
So let's say like US 23.
Right. And so one of the issues, I believe, is that, you know, we've built those roads to be basically open access roads. The federal government was involved in that financing. And for us to turn around and privatize those roads effectively, I'm sure the federal government would probably like to a piece of the action and probably want some return of the investments that it made in those roads. So I think that's one issue there. The toll roads that you referenced were never public roads necessarily, mm-hmm. and they've always been private roads.
Yeah. wondering what your thoughts are. At what point is enough enough? How bad does it have to get for that political will to get stronger and for a backbone to be grown, if you will, to be able to do what it takes to get these roads fixed? What's the breaking point?
I'm not sure. I thought that an improving economy was going to allow lawmakers to make the move to do this, and that appears not to be the case. I hope it's not something where we are turning roads over to gravel, but there's stories that that's happening in some local communities because of the inability to invest in the infrastructure. And clearly, there is a public safety concern with the quality of our roads. And, I would hate for somehow public safety to become the primary driver of this reform. But it's possible that may be the tipping point for renewed investment in roads.
Craig Thiels, a senior consultant at Anderson Economic Group. His recent article in Bridge Magazine is entitled, "Will There Ever Be a Good Time to Fund Road Repairs?" Thanks so much, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
When we think about buying food grown and made in Michigan, I think we often think about you and me, us Michiganders, going to the grocery store, going to a farmer's market, and that we are the ones consuming the goods. But there's a growing effort to export internationally more Michigan food. What would this mean for our state's farmers, for sellers or consumers, and for the state's economy? Joining us now are David Ortega, assistant professor in the Department of Agriculture, Food and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Hello, David.
Hi, Cynthia.
And Jamie Zmitko-Summers. She's with the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Cynthia.
So before we get into exactly what it would mean for Michigan to export more foods, first, let's get into context here. Jamie, how much do we send right now internationally, and where do we send it?
Yeah, currently in 2011, Michigan exported nearly $2.8 billion worth of food and agricultural products. We've seen at least 10% growth year over year over the last about 5 years, so that's very exciting. We are anticipating that once our 2012 numbers are released, those will again show some substantial growth. And we are working to meet the governor's objective of doubling ag exports that he gave us when he came into office a couple of years ago to about $3.5 billion. But we're certainly, hoping to go well beyond that and continue to increase our food and ag exports.
Where are we sending our food and ag
exports? Yeah, our top markets, our top five markets right now are Canada, Mexico, Japan, South Korea, and China. And Canada is by far our number one trading partner. About 60% of what we export is going into Canada. And that's, really for a couple of reasons. We share very close border with them. Consumers have very similar tastes. It's, fairly easy. I mean, not simple, but fairly easy for our Michigan companies to export there. And of course, we have that great free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico that certainly helps our products move into that market.
And what kind of products are we exporting? I mean, we would probably immediately assume some of the Michigan's staples like cherries or blueberries or apples.
Exactly. Yeah. Our top ag exports by dollar value are actually soybeans and corn, which kind of makes sense. We produce a lot of those here in Michigan. And certainly by dollar value, those are some top products. Certainly dairy is an important export as well. And you mentioned like cherries, blueberries. Those are also very important exports. Apples, fresh and processed from our state. Certainly vegetables are an important part. A lot of fresh vegetables will go back into Canada and be exported there. And then just a lot of various value-added food products and ingredients that are going into other markets, either for further for the ingredients to be used in other products that they're manufacturing in their countries, or finished goods that consumers around the world are, certainly tending towards more of a Western diet and certainly want U.S. products because they know they're high quality and safe.
So, David Ortega, where does this put Michigan in the global food economy? What kind of role are we playing?
Well, so we're starting to see Michigan play a big role in the consumer-oriented agricultural foods market. Just last year, just to kind of highlight what Jamie said, over 60% of exports were classified as consumer-oriented products that include meat, poultry, fresh vegetables, and snack foods. And what this means for the Michigan economy is that in recent years, we've seen the ag industry, and in particularly the livestock sector, it has suffered from high feed prices and decreased buying power of U.S. consumers. So this economic globalization and trade just opens up international markets to both U.S. and Michigan producers, ultimately boosting their profitability. And not just that, but this also leads to job growth. Just in 2011, there were approximately 17,000 agricultural export-related jobs in Michigan. So this makes food and ag exports extremely important to the state's economy.
And where do we compare with other states, David? Are we behind in terms of getting our foods out onto the international market?
Well, I believe we're about number 17 in terms of exports of food and agricultural products. The leading states being the big states of California and the West Coast and Texas. Those would fall ahead of us. But Michigan is extremely competitive in the ag export market.
What are some of the countries that we have not managed to crack that you would love to? I mean, you mentioned we've got a 60% going to Canada. There's Mexico, Japan, South Korea, and China. What other markets look promising?
Yeah, Brazil looks promising for a number of products. Certainly, they can be a very large competitor to us, but I think also provides some opportunity, especially as their economy grows, their middle class grows. They have some very large sporting events coming up in the next couple of years. I actually worked with a number of companies and the Michigan Apple Committee to do a trade mission down to Brazil in March, where we looked at opportunities in particular for fresh apples and blueberries. And they're very interested. And although they produce apples down there, they have a different growing season. So it has a perfect opportunity for Michigan to be able to supply apples during their off season and find an additional market for our products. And blueberries are a very new thing to Brazilian consumers, and they are very interested in new fruits, more northern fruits. And certainly that's, some opportunities there where we could move product into Brazil that, we wouldn't be necessarily competing with them. So that's, I think, a very, great emerging markets that we are looking at moving forward. I think India also has a lot of potential, in the next 5 to 10 years, certainly a very large economy, but still very restrictive on their food imports. So there's, we know that there's a lot of potential there. We just got to get past some hurdles to really be able to tap that market and get product moving into that market.
And it just seems that this push is really coming at a good time when you figure that 95% of the world's consumers are living outside of the United States.
Most definitely. And, like it was mentioned earlier, the top destinations include Canada by far. But of particular importance and interest is China. So China has been rising very rapidly as an emerging destination for Michigan ag exports. And, having done work in China myself for the past 5 years, there's tremendous market potential for U.S. and Michigan producers and products to make their way into the Chinese market. With rising incomes, we're seeing an emerging class of an emerging middle class in China with more disposable income. There's been a change in preferences, a change in diets. They're demanding more Western foods, more high-quality foods, and most importantly for Chinese consumers, they're demanding safer foods, which I think are all characteristics and attributes that Michigan producers and farmers and most certainly deliver.
That was David Ortega speaking. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Agriculture, Food, and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. And we're also speaking with Jamie Zmitko-Summers, who's with the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, and looking at the growing push to get Michigan food products out onto the international marketplace. As I read about this push, Jamie, it kind of feels like it's coming from the state rather than the farmers themselves. Do you think that's a fair conclusion, or have I gotten that wrong?
I think we're really seeing both. Certainly from the state level, we are, pushing to get the word out and certainly working with all of the different industry groups, commodity groups, and companies to really try to push that more. Just yesterday I was out meeting with a number of companies. A number of them are, vertically integrated companies that it's farmers who have, grow the product, are now processing the product, and are now either actively exporting or looking to export. So I think even, every down to the farmers and growers are seeing the benefits of exporting, and they know that, the domestic consumers are certainly important, but that the domestic market is, flat in growth in a lot of areas. And, you know, as David mentioned, you know, with countries like China where their middle class and the population is growing and demanding more high-quality foods and different types and styles of foods, they're seeing these opportunities and taking advantage of them, and certainly with the food safety as well. So I think it's, you know, something that's catching on around the state at all levels, everything from the growers all the way up to the companies that are buying products from the growers.
Did you have thoughts on that, David?
Well, I just kind of want to echo what Jamie said, is that, you know, the push is coming from both the state and farmers. The state kind of just lays the groundwork and provides information to farmers that are sometimes not aware of the export opportunities available for their products. So I think it's the drive is behind both the state and the farmers.
Now, I got to wondering about the possible consequences of this shift internationally. Is there any concern or any thought that this could negatively impact consumers in Michigan, David, that there might be suddenly too much of a focus overseas and those of us buying food here might lose out?
Well, no, I think the primary focus of Michigan farmers is first and foremost domestic consumers. And then, like it was stated, you know, there's tremendous opportunities outside of the U.S., but I don't think that there's any threats to American consumers or Michigan consumers of farmers looking at foreign markets for their products.
All right, then let me hop across the border or hop across the ocean. And thinking about consequences elsewhere in the world, what might this mean if we increase Michigan exports? What could this mean for the growers and the producers in the countries we're exporting to?
Well, so definitely those growers will face competition from the U.S., and that can be seen as both a positive and a negative. Looking at the negative first, we see they will face price competition, but then that also increases the incentives for them to produce higher quality and safer food products for their own consumers. So it can both be seen as a positive and negative for producers abroad.
So I kind of hear you say they're going to have to up their game.
Yes, most definitely.
Jamie, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with that. You know, we saw that I was able to travel with Director Clover Adams to China last year and Governor Snyder, and we looked at a lot of the opportunities both for export of our products into China as well as the export of services. So working with Chinese companies and government officials to export our training and expertise that we have in here in Michigan. And as David mentioned, they certainly, you know, can use some assistance. And we've heard a lot of this that, you know, they really need help in animal husbandry practices and food safety practices. So that's certainly things that we can help them with. And I think, you know, especially with China and some of these other countries, they are just growing so rapidly that in many cases, they're going to need local production plus products coming from the U.S. to meet the need and demand within those markets is kind of what I've been seeing. And I don't know if David, you know, would feel the same, but, you know, it seems like they really will need both to really keep up with the demand that they're having within their countries. And certainly we can help them both with the export of knowledge and technical assistance as well as actual products.
Right. No, it's most definitely a partnership between producers and government officials, both domestic and internationally. We just saw this past week big headlines of China acquiring or making a bid on Smithfield Foods in Virginia.
Yes.
And so we're seeing countries like China and emerging economies reaching out and looking for opportunities to augment and increase their domestic production.
Is that something American consumers should be worried about, hearing that China wants to come in and buy Smithfield, which is a long-standing American producer?
Well, I think the consequences of the merger, if it still has to be approved, if it goes through,
yes,
they won't be known for a few years. I don't think, you know, we see in the media consumers are worried about food safety, and especially, you know, a Chinese company taking,
yes,
over an American company. And I think operations in Smithfield are still going to go on smoothly. And it'll take some time to know exactly what the implications and ramifications are for U.S. consumers. But I don't think there's anything to worry in the short term.
I'm thinking of of a parallel here of another, we'll call it a product that is certainly tied to Michigan, and that is the automobile. And we've seen it, especially as Europe has been in such economic misery. So this globalized economy, you've got the auto companies now very tied into what's happening elsewhere in the world. Is it fair to think, David, this could happen to the agriculture industry in Michigan, that we could become too reliant on the ups and downs of other countries' economy?
Well, I mean, that's certainly a concern, but here in the U.S., we have certain regulations in place that will protect both consumers and producers from events like that having a tremendous effect on the local economy.
So you don't expect, because we certainly hear it from the way that that Ford and GM and Chrysler have to plan for the losses they're suffering in Europe, and it certainly is a major concern. You don't think that will happen to a Michigan farmer?
No, not as a result of you know, something like this merger between Shanghui and Smithfield. And on the contrary, I see it as sometimes a positive thing for farmers, where, you know, they would increase their production to supply into the foreign market, and that will increase their profitability in the long run.
James Mikko-Summers, if you had your way, how would things look, let's say, 10 years from now in terms of how much food and where Michigan's exporting?
Well, certainly, you know, if it was up to me, I'd like to see more companies exporting to new and different markets and exporting for the first time. You know, our exports would continue to grow, and we would move, you know, from kind of that 17th, 18th position, you know, up maybe into the top 10, I think would be great. You know, our producers and growers here are producing so many great products and are producing more than they have ever in the past. You know, we're looking at record cherry and apple crops this year, and certainly they're going to need to find markets for those products. So I think, you know, in the next 10 years, I'd like to see us, you know, really have a foothold in a number of international markets, and, you know, companies really looking to export markets for a way to diversify their sales, because it helps them and helps companies in the long run when they have multiple markets. So if there is an economic downturn in one country, whether it be the U.S. or a foreign market, they're really diversified and, you know, maybe don't have that effect, which I think is why we've seen the agriculture industry do so well the last few years, just because of the diversification and the fact that everyone does need to eat.
And David Ortega, your thoughts looking down the road, say 10 years out from here?
Well, I definitely see Michigan, you know, hopefully moving into the top 10 states that export ag products. China's going to play a big role in moving Michigan up on that list. Brazil, like Jamie mentioned, you know, they're hosting the World Cup and the Olympics. They're an emerging economy. We're going to see consumers seeking these specialty food products that we produce here in the state of Michigan, cherries, apples, being demanded by this emerging class. And so I think things are looking very positive for ag exports out of the state in the next 10 years.
David Ortega is assistant professor of the Department of Agriculture, Food, and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. And we've also been speaking with James Mikko-Summers, who's with the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. Thank you so much to both of you for talking with us today.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Turning now to election 2014. Specifically, the U.S. Senate seat that will open up as Democrat Carl Levin retires. Michigan Congressman Gary Peters announced last month he will run for the Democratic nomination, but there appeared to be some hesitation on the part of Republicans. That is, until this week, when former Michigan Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land announced she will run as a Republican in that Senate race. Terry Lynn Land joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Hey, great to be with you guys.
So on top of two terms as Secretary of State, you are currently a Republican National Committee woman. What brings you into the race for Senate?
Well, as a former Secretary of State, as you mentioned, and serving locally as a county clerk, I've always thought about serving in the federal government, and to have that opportunity would truly be an honor to serve this great state of Michigan. And when Senator Levin announced his retirement and that he wasn't going to run, which we thank him for his service and appreciate the fact he's given some time for folks to make that decision about running for the United States Senate, I thought about it and talked to my family and my supporters and friends, and it's a big decision. But as you know, there were a lot of other capable candidates in our Republican congressional delegation, and I pretty much assumed that one of them would run. Well, as you know, they said no, with only one out there left, with Congressman Rogers, who's serving as the chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the Congress. And so I talked to him multiple times, and finally I just said, you know, Congressman Rogers, I really would like to do this, and I'm going to run. And he wished me well. We had a good conversation and got in on Monday. Looking forward to serving this great state in the U.S. Senate.
Now, is there any sense that Congressman Rogers or perhaps Congressman Amash might say, you know what, yeah, I want to run too?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And like I said, I had a great conversation. You know, that's something that they're going to have to make their own decision. I've made mine. I've looked at what best would work for me in this race. And to me, we have these wonderful, beautiful Michigan summer days, as we have today. And then we have these tough, sometimes, Michigan winters. And you really need the opportunity to get out in this state. This is a relationship state. People want to hear you. They want to talk to you. They want to shake your hand. And they want you to listen. And you need that time to do that. This is a big decision. This is someone that's going to serve in the U.S. Senate. It's a, you know, a term that you're going to be there for a while. So people want to be able to make the right choice. And I think it's important as candidates to get that out there and listen.
So you feel kind of the two summers is needed to campaign for this seat.
Yeah, I've run before, as you know, twice statewide as a Secretary of State, and been to every nook and cranny from Bessemer up in the UP to Monroe down in Monroe County and Detroit and Grand Rapids and Alpena and everything in between. And it's a beautiful state, wonderful people, and I want to be out there and talk to them about our vision for Michigan and our country.
With that in mind, as you say that about the two summers, I spoke with Bobby Shostak, the chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, last week, kind of asked why a Republican had not jumped in at that point. You had not made your intentions known. And he said he thought it was fine if candidates waited until the fall to announce. Do you think there's a little bit of a disconnect there?
Well, you know, I've won twice statewide. And again, back to the point about being a relationship state, and, you know, everyone else has to make their own decision and what they want to do and how they want to run their race. But obviously the Democratic establishment has made their decision and coalesced around one candidate for the Senate. So they feel it strongly that it's time to get out there and talk to the voters about what's going on in the federal government and what their skill set is to bring to that. And that's where I think I bring something. You know, I've been a manager of a $1 billion operation, the Secretary of State's office, thousands of employees, and I think right now with some of the issues that we've got with the IRS, with the Attorney General's office, we need somebody with that skill set of management and oversight. And, you know, I think transparency is an answer here. We put all of our finances online at the Department of State, what we spent, all the money that came in. We're very transparent. And these federal agencies now have gotten so huge that in order to have good oversight, you need to do that so folks know what's going on. And then you need to get out from behind those hearing desks. I appreciate the hearings that are going on, and those questions need to be asked of those department heads. But to give an example of what I've done is when I was county clerk, I actually went into a department of the state to find out what was going on. As county clerk, you do vital records, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those records are kept at the state, and a lot of our customers were telling me that they weren't getting them in a timely manner. So I took a state representative, Harold Voorhees, and he and I went and visited the director, and I could see when I got there that they really needed some modernization, some technology in order to make them more efficient. He went back to the legislature and got that done. And then I continued with that when I was Secretary of State and actually gave a grant to the community health in order to make their death records accessible online. So it's two things, and I think that's definitely something that I would bring to the U.S. Senate.
I'm speaking with former Michigan Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land, who has announced she will run as a Republican in the race for the Senate seat that's going to open up when Democrat Carl Levin retires. Now, I mentioned I spoke with Bobby Shostak a little about Michigan political history last week, and I want to ask you a question that I asked him at the same time. And that's this, that you can look at both of the Senate seats from our state. Carl Levin has had a lock on it since he beat Republican Robert Griffin in 1978. And for Senator Stabenow's seat, Spencer Abraham's single term that was 1995 to 2001 was the only win for the GOP since Charles Potter back in the 1950s. So what kind of chance do you think a GOP candidate legitimately has of winning the race to replace Carl Levin? What would it take?
Well, it's going to take a lot of work. And again, like I mentioned, it's going to take getting out there. And I think that just proves the point here, how important it is to get started and to start talking to folks about what's important for Michigan and for our country. And that's why we're getting started and we're out there talking to folks. So, it's going to be a tough race. I don't think that's, something that we don't all understand. But it's an important race, and there's a lot of things that are going on in this economy right now. People want to know that there's going to be a job, and it's going to be a good job, that they can support their families. They want to know that the economy is going to be stable. They want to know that the federal government, like the state government here in Michigan, is going to balance their budget on time and be able to deliver the services that are needed for our folks here in our country. And that's really the important thing, and that's the number one issue. So we need to be out there talking to folks about that.
Well, winning this seat, as we know, any political race, but particularly something on the national level, it takes money. It takes a lot of money. Do you have the base and the name recognition and the fundraising prowess to raise the money that's going to be needed?
Definitely. And this is the issue of today. Times have changed a little bit. Yes, you need to raise the money here in Michigan that will help you get your message across. But on top of that, we now have a new dynamic in the fundraising area, and that's the super PACs. Mm-hmm. And this will be now about the third cycle that these folks have been through this, and everything from Liberty PACs on the libertarian side to MoveOn.org on the liberal side will be out there working and supporting candidates. So even whatever you raise locally in the state, you got to realize that they can come in with $10 million with an ad buy, and that changes the dynamics of the race. So there's a lot of other moving parts out there, so you have to just do your best, raise what you can raise here in Michigan in order to get your message across, but realize that you do now have those other entities of super PACs out there that can come on in.
That's Republican National Committee woman and former Michigan Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land, who announced this week she will run for the open Michigan Senate seat in 2014. And you can hear my conversation with Congressman Gary Peters. He announced he's running as a Democrat in that race. You can find it on the website, MichiganRadio.org. When you hear the phrase social media and think of what that phrase represents, Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, Tumblr, and so many more, it seems really strange to think that not even a decade ago, many of us had never even heard that term, social media. And with so many choices, you can find the social media site that truly reflects your interest or your goals for social media network. Or if you can't find one, you could do what my next guest did, come up with their own social media site. It's a new site called Hubski, developed by a couple of native Ann Arborites. And I'm joined by these two co-founders, Steve Klausnitzer, who's joining us from North Carolina. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. And here in the studio with me is Mark Katakowski. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, thanks.
So, Mark, you have this whole other life, and the question has to be asked, how does a guy who does brain tumor research for Henry Ford Hospital wind up creating a new social media site?
Well, I guess the short answer is I have a lot of hobbies. But the longer answer is I got into it actually to teach myself how to program. And I've always been fascinated with the internet and fascinated with media. I spent a lot of time on internet forums, news aggregators. But I wasn't finding exactly what I thought should be out there.
And what was that?
A place for really meaningful interaction among the people. There's, I think, a lot of potential when you gather a whole bunch of people from all walks of life and all around the world to discuss a certain topic or event or idea. And I think that there was just a lot of potential out there that wasn't being, tapped or leveraged to really encourage that aspect of the equation. And so that looked like a project that was worth, doing. And as I taught myself to program, and that's where I started. And it's kind of snowballed from there.
Okay, what are you feeling, Steve, that number one attracted you so much, and number two made you say, you know what, I do want to become a part of this formally and make this a part of my life? What was it about Hubski?
Well, the other day I was talking with Mark, and he mentioned to me, and this may sound a little silly, but he said that Hubski to him was like what he pictured Paris in the 20s to be, interesting people doing interesting things in a small localized area. And that's what attracted me. There's people on the site posting original artwork, photography, music, essays on science and literature. So it's just a lot of really thoughtful, active people. So the idea that the internet is a place for people to go waste time is not something that I think our users buy into. You know, they're on the site interacting in a meaningful way. And what attracted me to the site right off the get-go was that I didn't see people just having conversations with each other, and then that was the one interaction they'd ever have. I saw people developing relationships around common interests. And I think that's fascinating as we move into a world where the line between, you know, in real life and online life is constantly being blurred.
So I'm interested if you could, as the guy who originally created this, Mark, how would you describe it to someone who has not seen Hubsky? Is it like Facebook? Is it like Twitter? What's it like?
So when you get on, I mean, Hubsky's a website. When you come there, it's going to look like a wall of text.
Yeah, okay.
Because there's a whole lot of, and you'll see kind of a feed of different stories and posts and things that people are talking about. And so that's what you'll first see. But when you log in, you'll be suggested maybe somebody to follow based on what interest you might have.
Okay.
And that kind of gets you into the community. You kind of put a toe in it. And what'll happen is you start to see users that are posting content and then sharing content amongst each other. And what you'll get is your own personalized slice of Hubsky. There is no Hubsky that everybody has, actually. And that's kind of one of the natures of the site, is that everybody has their own personal version of it. And I think because of that kind of organic nature of the site, it encourages stronger relationships between the users and then more meaningful interaction between them.
Steve, what kind of posts and conversation threads are up there? Give us an idea of the kinds of posts you attract.
Sure. It's really all over the place. But to be more specific, right before I joined the call, I took a look at our trending tags on Hubsky. So some of the trending topics people are interested in, and the top ones listed are right now, and it could change.
Sure.
But right now are science, technology, politics, music, and, you know, these are things that most of us are passionate about. So they tend to fall into buckets like that, but they get really creative with it. People actually use Hubsky as not just a place to share stuff they've consumed elsewhere, but people actually create original content on Hubsky too. So they'll post essays that they've written on Hubsky, photo essays. We allow people to embed photos in their work. So those are some of the things that you'll see on Hubsky. Also, community events people are hosting, and this is neat because what's really great about creating a site like this is when you sit back and just watch people use it in ways you didn't necessarily imagine. But people are creating book clubs and are working on art projects together on the site. There's someone who challenged the musicians in the community to record children's songs for his mother's preschool class. So,
wow.
There's just lots of really neat creativity happening on the site.
How do you keep the conversation in the tone that you want, which is thoughtful and respectful?
If I could take it, I think one way we do that is what you see is based on who you follow. So if you're not, and there's not friending and unfriending. There's not this relation. So it's more passive. And so you're not going to upset somebody if you're not following them. And so what happens is, you know, you'll follow somebody, and if they're not for you, then you might, you know, let them go and unfollow them. And that's kind of what happens. I think one thing I think that the site has that I really appreciate is serendipity. There's a lot of, because you're following people rather than topics, what you'll get is, you know, these kind of the whole aspect of somebody's personality. And I think what happens in online often is what people do is they'll put up some topics and people go there to discuss this topic, whether it's politics or programming or
whatnot.
But on Hubsky, what we do is we kind of put up the people, and then you follow the people. And what happens from that, I think in the real world, that's more that, and we think that's more like the real world because what I do and what I listen to isn't generally based on what the majority has agreed to be the most popular. It's generally what I do is I'll find people that interest me, and we'll go do things together. And that's kind of how things work out on Hubsky. You kind of find your niche over time by seeking out these people. And
how many members of the community do you have now?
We're just about 7,000 now. And so we're small, but we are energetic. And I think one of the greatest things about it is people that joined 2 years ago are still there, and there's a lot of them. And we've kind of formed some bonds with them. I've actually made some real-life friendships through the site. And so I think we're doing the right thing. We're not really advertising. We're just kind of growing as, you know, people filter in.
Do you have a sense as to where people are located? Are you going
around
the world?
They're all over the world.
They
are. We've got people in, yeah, from, we have, seems like we have a lot of people in Denmark for some reason, but we have, we have, yeah, people, Singapore, we've had people, Thailand, Vietnam, Brazil, everywhere, yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, Mark just mentioned that, you know, we've actually made friends with people through the site, and these are people that there's no way I would have met otherwise. So made friendships, and we have friends in Toronto and Vancouver, New Zealand, people that I genuinely care about what they're working on and what they're doing in life. So it's definitely global.
The site is Hubski, and it's HUBSKI.com. Where'd you get the name from? Gotta ask.
Well, I was trying to think of a name, and I was News Hub. You know, this is a hub of information. Well, my last name is Katakowski, so I just stuck on the ski. And
there you go. Represent Poland, right?
Yeah.
There we go. Hubski.com, and I have been speaking with the co-founders, Mark Katakowski, here in the studio, and joining us from North Carolina, Steve Klausnitzer. And thanks so much for sharing your story with us, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you,
it's a pleasure.
You.